Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Today is Tech Update Day, and we'll talk about the battery health of your phone or laptop, among other things, with our guest, Beth D'Angelo, Senior IT Specialist at UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology, or DOIT, as we like to call it around here. As we talk with her, I hope you'll join in. Tell us how long your phone battery lasts. What have you done to extend the battery life of your laptop? And, of course, we'll take your general technology questions as well, and I hope you do join in. The number to call is 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. ideas@wpr.org. And Beth D'Angelo, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Good morning, Larry. Thanks for having me.
We get a lot of listeners calling into the show wondering about charging their electronics, the best ways and so forth. And I know a lot of us just plug them in at night, regardless of how charged they are. Is that a good practice?
Well, it can be a little bit damaging to your battery to just leave it charged, for long periods of time without disconnecting it from the power source. So the nice thing about most phones these days, there's actually been updates to the operating systems that help reduce the amount of damage that can cause to your phone battery if you just leave it charging past the 100% mark. But it still can cause dead spots over time. So generally the recommendation is to, what they call it, is like to soft charge and discharge the phone. So meaning not letting the phone battery get below 50%, and then also only charging it up to close to 100%, or at least not leaving it on the charger once it's reached the 100% battery capacity. So it's the... not letting it run all the way down, and then not letting it sit on the charger beyond the point where it's actually fully charged.
So if you're doing it at night, a lot of times you're going to be over 100% charged way before the alarm goes off.
Yeah, some of the phones actually now will, they have like a throttling system where they will optimize the battery charging. So like my iPhone knows my charging habits after a little while and will optimize it so it reaches its fully charged by a certain time. So it kind of allows the charge to happen slower than it normally would when I plug it in at night. So you can go into the power settings on your phone and generally mess around with some of that optimization if you want to.
Okay. So the best ways to make your battery function better and longer term?
Really is to kind of abide by that, not letting the battery get too low. So when you let it discharge to close to 0% and then recharge it fully from there, that's a lot more strain on the actual battery than if you were to only let it get down to 50% and then charge it back up to, say, like 95% and then use it back down to 50%. That's less strenuous on the battery. Also, taking care to make sure your devices don't get overheated. So if you're charging, say you're charging your phone in your car, maybe your phone's sitting on your dashboard and the sun is beating down on it, that excess heat can really cause damage to your battery over time. And that's actually a risk for fire.
Yeah, I wondered about that. There is some of the lithium ion batteries are found to have caused fires.
Yeah, that's been happening and reported in the media a lot lately, especially with the larger devices that are being powered by lithium-ion batteries like cars and electric bicycles and scooters and things like that. And really, the reason I think why those fires are I guess, more dramatic than people would expect is that lithium-ion batteries hold a lot more energy than your normal battery would. So, the older style batteries that we had held a lot less energy than these new batteries do. And once a fire starts and that energy starts to release, it really can take off very quickly and they're very difficult to put out those fires. So they're quite dangerous.
There are some at-home kits that make it possible for people to replace their phone batteries. How easy is it to replace a laptop battery at home, for example? Let's take laptops.
A laptop battery would be much easier than doing something like a cell phone, simply because generally a laptop battery is a component piece of the laptop that is held on by either a detachable. There's usually like a mechanism that locks it in place that you can slide over with a screwdriver, or sometimes it's just a locking back and forth mechanism that you can push with your thumb that will pop the battery out of place. And if you purchase a battery from the same manufacturer, it should fit based on the model of laptop you're dealing with. So, you know, say, for instance, you have a Dell laptop and you want to replace that battery, I would go with a Dell-branded battery replacement rather than going with a third-party vendor that's making a similar battery, just ensuring that the component parts are meeting the same standard that the original manufacturer had set it up for. That's going to ensure that you get a longer lasting and more effective, safer battery that you replace.
Yeah.
I see. On a phone, I would really recommend doing that yourself. Unless you have the proper tools, I would generally recommend taking it into a shop to have the phone battery replaced properly.
Yeah. I know tech experts say to look for UL certified batteries. What does it mean if a battery has, UL, Underwriters Laboratory? Is that, I think it stands for?
Yeah, that's the research organization that tests electrical products for safety. So they maintain a level of safety standards that's legislated and agreed to, so that devices can go through a rigorous process of testing to ensure their safety. Within those, you know, technical constraints. So looking for that UL listed sticker, or another one is CE, which is the European equivalent. So devices that are manufactured in Europe would have a CE sticker on them, similar to the UL.
Okay, that makes sense as well. Back to the hot part for a minute. You know, if your device is really gets hot to the touch while you're charging it, you should probably pull it off the charge?
Yeah, that can happen, especially if something is maybe stacked on top of the phone while it's plugged in. If it doesn't have, enough air circulation around the device. It could also happen with certain phone cases. I've especially seen it with some of the magnetic wireless charging cases, that there can be a lot of heat conducted between those magnetic conductors, and sometimes those can get pretty hot. So you just want to be careful that, you know, you've got an open space around the phone, that there's nothing stacked on top of it. And I'd be careful with the rechargers that are wireless, that they're not conducting a lot of heat.
Hmm. And, you know, you go to the airport anymore and other places as well. There are charging ports in airports or at some gas stations now as well. How safe are public charging stations?
Yeah, my experience is the ones in airports rarely actually work. They're pretty useless. Once they've been there a little while, especially the USB ones, they break pretty easily. I tend to actually look for an actual outlet and plug in my own charging brick rather than using a USB charger in a public place. I'm also a little bit paranoid about any device that might be behind a USB charger. USB cords also transmit data. So plugging my device in through my own power brick to an actual, you know, 2 or 3 prong plug in the wall feels a little bit better to me.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Richard in Spring Green shot us an email. He's changing his internet provider. And he's wondering, how fast does his internet need to be? All he does is answer emails, occasionally streams Netflix on his smart TV.
Yeah, really, if you're looking just to do the basic internet functions, nothing really fancy, the rule that I generally go by is for streaming content, usually in order to not get buffering for streaming video content, you want at least a 6 megabit connection. Anything beyond that, of course, you're going to be in pretty good shape. But below that level, you may see buffering with video. And especially if you're running multiple devices that are streaming at once, you want to make sure you have multiples of that number then.
And an email from Jimmy: purchased an iPhone 14 Pro. Is the phone's internal security system enough, or does he need to purchase an outside program like Norton? He was told that the phone system wasn't enough.
Yeah, I mean, I would generally recommend putting some sort of a secondary provider's security on any device that I'm using, rather than just relying on the tools that are native to the device that come with the operating system. Norton is always a good option for that. What's nice about Norton is you can buy a service that will protect all of your devices, so it's not piecemeal, where you can sign up for a subscription that would provide you with protection for a laptop or a desktop computer, and also any Android or Apple iPhone device that you have signed up for your subscription, so you can kind of manage it all in one place.
And we get another email from Mary in Arcadia. Another question about Wi-Fi. What should she do if her internet gets disconnected? Which boxes should she restart, and how can she know if her internet's been restored?
That is a good question. So usually when you're getting broadband internet from a provider, you have either one or two devices in your house that are really providing that Wi-Fi out to your device, your iPhone or your laptop or whatever you have connected to your Wi-Fi. You're going to have a router, which is the device that the actual signal comes in through and then is distributed out to other devices in your house. And then oftentimes you'll have a secondary device that is just the Wi-Fi side of the router. So the incoming internet device that usually is provided by your internet service provider. So if you're with Charter, they give you a device, often doesn't have a Wi-Fi built into it, so you need a secondary device to provide that Wi-Fi. If you have two, the order of operations to try to fix things would be to reboot the router first, so where your internet connection is coming into, and then once that internet router is rebooted, then you reboot your Wi-Fi router and wait for that to pick up a connection. I would wait for all of the lights on your internet router, so that first device, to be on and active before you reboot that second device, if you do have a second one. If you still don't have an internet connection after both of those have been rebooted, I would give a call to your internet service provider and see if they can help you with further troubleshooting. It may be that your service is out, and that's something that they would have to tell you.
Beth D'Angelo, our guest today, senior IT specialist at UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. Questions for her? Tech question? I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@WPR.org, ideas@WPR.org. Trina LaSousa is our engineer today. Clara Neipert, our producer. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Thanks for listening in on the Ideas Network today. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Beth D'Angelo. We're talking tech updates today, answering your technology questions, and I hope you'll join in. Number to call is 1-800-642-1234, or you could email to ideas@WPR.org. Back to firmware. Someone else was wondering, how do you update your routine firmware? And speaking of firmware, what is it?
Right. I know firmware is a strange term. Well, I'm sure everyone has heard of software. Software being, you know, what the programs that live on your computer that run various, you know, routines and handle tasks for you. Firmware is, a little bit of a play on words. It's more of the internal hard wiring of the system. So firmware is what your hardware uses to basically communicate with the software on your machine. So it's kind of that in-between middle ground where the technical physical components of the machine then need to be able to work in conjunction with the various operating system and programs that are running on the software side. So updating firmware is a little bit different from updating software. Generally, it is a device level update, so the device is not available for use while that's running. Oftentimes, there's several reboots that are required during a firmware update. But what it's doing is removing various like vulnerabilities or faults or bugs within the system that have been, developed within testing of a piece of hardware or things that have been reported to manufacturers as faults or issues within hardware that can be fixed with updating this particular type of program.
Let's take some calls. Nancy in Grafton, we'll go to you. Nancy, hi, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, I only have a landline phone, and I do not want to get one of those other things because I'm pretty darn old. And I started out with two tin cans and a string before that on our farm. But anyway, how in the heck, you know, AT&T, you know, they charge me, and I've been with them for years, they charge me about $60 a month, and that's not long distance. And I got to pay a little extra money with another little company. But how can I contact, AT&T, they won't let you, you know, you can't write to them or anything. I just sent them a check again today. But it's just, it sounds crazy, but I, you know, I'm pretty old and I'm not going to go and get involved with all this computer stuff and all that.
But. Well, I tell you what, so Nancy wants to lower her bill. This may be an issue, but how would you lower your bill for a landline phone?
You know, honestly, I've had the best luck lowering any kind of bill, like whether it be like a landline phone or cable TV bill or internet service by just giving the company a call and telling them that I want to leave their service. Anytime I have said that I would like to discontinue service, I've been offered a very large discount to continue to use them as a service provider. AT&T, they do have a phone number that you can call for assistance. I know sometimes it can be really difficult to try to get through to big companies like this, but if you just want to try to get hold of a human being, you can reach them at 866-440-7420. That's 866-440-7420. So I suggest giving them a call and saying that you're tired of them, you want to discontinue your service, and seeing what they offer you, because generally they'll offer you a very steep discount at that point.
There you go, Nancy. Again, that's 866-440-7420. Maybe we can put that up on our page today, Clara. So there you go, Nancy. Thank you so much for that call. Let's go to Steve in Reedstown then. Steve, hi.
Hi, how are you? I was just wondering, about the exploitation in countries around the world that are where we're obtaining our cobalt and all the necessary minerals for our devices. Like, how do we feel good about where these things are coming from and the exploitation in these countries to get it?
Interesting question. And Beth, what's your response?
Yeah, certainly it's a huge issue with the rate at which we are using up the natural resources of, certain countries that are prone to exploitation because they have made deals with other more powerful countries to extract resources, or they don't have strong enough governments of their own to kind of control the exploitation or flow of resources out of countries. I know it's been a huge problem in many parts of Africa, especially with cobalt, like you mentioned. The Congo is having some pretty serious issues with that. And really, honestly, about feeling good about how these minerals and precious metals are extracted from countries like this, it's not something you can feel good about, other than finding ways to not, I guess, perpetuate the cycle, finding programs for recycling devices to be able to extract the metals that were used in older devices to be recycled and used in future devices, I think, is a possibility. In some way, donating money or time to organizations that help fight back against this type of exploitation is a way that, you know, we can somewhat offset our usage of the devices that are produced by that. Honestly, it's kind of a moral question we all have to ask ourselves when we buy these things.
Yeah, absolutely. Steve, thank you for calling. Well, let's go to Tim in Camp Douglas. Hi, Tim.
Yeah. Say, I'd just like to know, how often should I have my computer cleaned up or maintenanced or whatever the term is? That's my question. I'll take it offline.
A couple different ways of we could think about cleaning and maintaining.
Yeah, generally, having some robust antivirus or computer security program running on your machine, something like a Norton 360. There are multiple options out there that you can purchase for your device or your laptop. As far as cleaning it out, there are routine tasks that those software programs can run where they scan for any potential malware or viruses or anything on your computer that could be problematic. There are also tools that you can download that are specific to looking for malware. I would also make sure you run any of the operating system updates on your machine. So if you're on a Windows machine, running Windows updates regularly or having that scheduled to run automatically is a very good idea. Same if you're on a Macintosh, you can run software updates on that every time they update the iOS. So making sure your antivirus software is up to date. So that'll also run scheduled updates to make sure it has the most current virus scanning tools available to it. Those are the types of maintenance things that I would do regularly, at least monthly, running your antivirus, running your Windows updates, things like that. But as far as having anyone do any kind of cleaning or fixing or tuning on it, it's not really like a car where you need to take it in for a tune-up at 100,000 miles. It's really just keeping up with those software programs that are meant to protect it.
In terms of the physical cleaning of it, there's not much we need to do, is there, just to keep the dust off?
Yeah, I mean, you'd be surprised at how much gunk gets collected inside your computer. So if you've got, say, a desktop computer, that's what I would be most concerned about. A laptop isn't going to have much get into it. They're pretty self-contained. But desktop computers, towers, those have multiple fans internally and externally that move air through them in order to cool the parts and components inside of it. Those can pull in dust, debris, pet hair, food crumbs, whatever you may have around them. And it can get pretty icky inside those if they run constantly and are never cleaned out. Usually there are a couple of screws on the tower that you can remove that will allow you to slide a panel off of the side of your tower. You can slide that panel off, get to the inside, and take an air duster, one of those cans of air, and spray out the various things that get, gunked up inside of it. It's pretty gross. But yeah. You'll be real surprised when you open it up the first time.
Oh, boy. Tim, thanks again. Appreciate it. Adrian in Rockford, Illinois, will take your question. Hi, thank you for calling.
Oh, yes. Thank you so much for taking my question. Your guest described the rules how to properly charge the phone capacity, like 50% to 80%. I didn't follow those. I basically kept it plugged in all the time for about 3 years that I had it. And I've noticed that recently it started getting hot when I use it. And I wonder if that's because of the way I charge the battery. And if it is, if I change the way I charge it, would that battery become good again? If that was the cause. And well, thank you.
All right, Adrian, thanks. The iPhone, a couple years old, it gets hot when he uses it. And was it the fault of his constantly charging?
You know, it may be that the battery has some damage to it, or it certainly could have some dead spots in it and not really charge properly anymore. One thing I would try to reduce the amount of heat that builds up when it's charging is removing it from the case while it's charging to see if it's still building up a lot of heat. If it is, it's possible that there is some damage to that battery. Being more mindful about how you're charging it in the future would certainly help to prevent more damage, but it's not really going to reverse what's already kind of going bad in there. It may be time to look into having the battery replaced if that's a possibility on your phone.
Yeah. And those covers, yeah, they can be, you think about it, you got a cover over it, over your phone. I can see why heat could build up and be a problem.
Yeah, another thing that I didn't mention earlier that I will hear is to ensure that you're, you know, treating your battery in the way that it was meant to be treated, using a charger that is made by the same manufacturer as your device is also kind of important. And I know that sometimes you can, you know, get a much cheaper version that's a different brand. But the component parts and the way those are made isn't exactly to the manufacturer's specification who built the device. So as much as it pains me to spend $50 on an iPhone charger that's made by Apple, I know that it's going to more properly charge my device and is less likely to cause damage or overheating or overcharging on the device in the long run. So, you know, spending $50 on another charger rather than $20 on an off-brand one can save you money in the long term.
Adrian, thank you again. Bill in Wausau, we go to you next. Hi, Bill.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I've got an older MacBook Pro that they tell me is vintage. I don't know, it's 8 years old or 10. And the problem I have is it very easily types duplicate letters without my intention. And the problem for that is when I try to log on with the password, when I first turn it on, it often takes me a 3 or 4 tries, and I have to be very, very careful to only tap on the keys. What can I do about that? It's too old to replace the works for the keyboard. Do I just have to continue like I'm doing?
Yeah, it may be that, you know, that something underneath the keyboard is sticking. You know, you may want to try blowing out the keyboard with a can of air to see if there's any, like, you know, little pieces of debris that have gotten stuck in some keys that may be holding it down. Or it also could be that the keyboard itself is really just wearing out after that many years of use. That can happen. And something you could try is plugging an external keyboard into it. If you have an old, you know, USB keyboard that you can plug in, you may want to try plugging that in and using it. Other than that, it may be too old to replace that keyboard, and you may have to let the 8 to 10 year old MacBook go.
All right, Bill, there you go. Thank you so much. You can join in too. Open lines get you on pretty quickly here. The number to call is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. And speaking of emails, Judy in Plover emailed, how can people be sure their Wi-Fi is not accessible to outsiders? She has some shady neighbors, and she doesn't want them downloading illegal content on her Wi-Fi waves. And she also wonders, how can she change her router password?
Yeah, that is a great question. So I was going to say, first and foremost, you're going to want to make sure you have a strong password set for your Wi-Fi access. So using something that has multiple uppercase and lowercase letters, you know, try not to use like known names or you know, addresses or anything like that. Using a combination of letters and numbers, something that's more than 15 characters, adding in any special characters, all of those things are going to help create a password that is much more difficult for anyone to guess or crack in any way. As far as accessing the Wi-Fi router in order to change the password, usually what you'll need to do is to, on a machine that is connected to your Wi-Fi network, you're going to need to open a web browser window, and there's an address that you can type in that'll, on almost every Wi-Fi router, is the same, and it's a number. It's kind of strange. It's 128.0.0.1 is usually the router address.
What is it? 128.
.0.0.1.
Okay.
That's generally nowadays the default router address. That's going to take you to a browser screen that'll show you the admin page for your router. Usually that is password protected. If this isn't the correct address for your particular router, it will be in the documentation that came with it. You just want to look for how to access the admin screen. If you don't have the documentation, you can also look up your router model. So if you look at the make and model of it, of the actual device, do a Google search for it and search for admin tools or admin site. That will tell you how to get to the actual screen where you can go in and change the password for your router. But it's generally that 128.0.0.1.
Okay. Carol in Eagle has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Carol.
Hi. I am a sustaining member for National Public Television, and they tell me that I have their streaming service. That's all I know. How do I get that streaming service onto my smart television?
Hmm.
I actually went through this similar thing with my television a while back. I'm also a sustaining member, and so I get this magazine called Passport from them in the mail. I think it's called Passport.
Yeah.
And it, I think it in there it walks through the process of connecting to the service. But I remember there was a PBS app that I downloaded on my smart TV, and it asked me for login and password information. And I believe I found it through either that magazine that they send to me or through going to the PBS website and signing up for it through a number that was on that Passport magazine.
Okay.
Mary, maybe you can help with this since...
Yeah, and I know if our public TV people here at our service desk have often answered that question, and I don't have the number off the top of my head, unfortunately, but Wisconsin Public Television, I know the folks out there have answered this a number of times for people. But I think you're right about Passport, because I've got that too, the Passport magazine that comes in the mail. So, Carol, there you go. And if you're still confused, you could call Wisconsin Public Television, the 800 number, and which I can't give you off the top of my head. Audience Services. Oh, wait a minute. Clara's came right in for me here. 800-747-7444. 800-747-7444. That's Audience Services. And they can hopefully help you out. There you go. Let's see. We've got a listener emailed us. They have occasionally received an extortion email claiming their device has been hacked and demand Bitcoin payment. These are phishing scams. Is there any chance they could be legitimate?
Really, anything that comes in through email like that is not going to be legitimate. I would give it a 99.9% certainty that it is some sort of phishing scam. Don't ever click on any links associated with those emails. Don't open the email. If you have an email service that allows you to report it as phishing or as spam, go through the process to report it and then delete it from your system.
Yeah, that makes a very, very, very good sense. Jeremy emailed, heard that charging directly to car USB ports is bad for the iPhone and could, and one should use a device that sends a clean sine wave. Is that true?
Well, I'm not certain about the electrical engineering part of it, but I do think that charging via a USB port from a car may be potentially damaging for a battery in that the, you know, the, I guess the electrical current that you're getting from that USB charger may not be calibrated to the right voltage for your specific device. I know in my car, I have an actual AC outlet that I can plug a regular two-prong plug into. I plug a brick into that and then run a USB out of it in order to get cleaner power to my device when I'm plugged in my car.
Let's go to Bill in Oregon next. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Larry, Beth. Got a Galaxy A51 that was working great, and then after an update, it ceased to do mobile data. It does Wi-Fi just fine. I've tried the initial basic of just going airplane mode and turning it off, then went to resetting the network connections, and then tried a full factory reset, and it doesn't seem to resolve the issue in any way, and I'm just wondering if you have any ideas.
Sounds interesting.
So after the update, it's just not doing mobile data, but you can like get data to travel through Wi-Fi or that functioning.
Is that correct? Sorry, Bill. Go ahead. We lose Bill? Oh, we lost him. I think that's what he was getting at.
Yeah. Sounded like it. I know that I'm not as familiar with the Samsung phones, but I know there is a way to reset your network settings on it. That's something that could potentially with an update to the device's operating system, it could have like a buggy setting or something got switched that shouldn't be. If you go into your network settings, there is a reset option where it will reset it back to default. Other than that, like force restarting your device, so rebooting it fully may help. If you still aren't able to get mobile data, I would definitely reach out to your service provider. So if you depending on who your phone service is through, I would reach out to them to see if there's something wrong with your data on your account.
All right. Thank you very much for that question. Appreciate it. Beth D'Angelo, our guest today, she is a senior IT specialist with UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. And we have open lines. Get you on pretty quickly. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email to ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, talking technology today. Your computers, your phones, your laptops, and everything else. Watch everything else with our guest today, Beth D'Angelo, with the UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. Questions, give a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. And let's go to Jeremy in Bayfield. Jeremy, hi.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
I have a follow-up question regarding charging your phone in your car.
I have a device that I think it's an inverter or a transformer, which I'm not sure which is which, that creates a clean sine wave. And I was told that that was a better way to do it if you're going to charge in your car. Is that true?
Hmm. What do you think, Beth?
Yeah, I'm just okay. So it's called a pure sine wave generator, something that creates like a cleaner version of AC power. I'm not sure, you know, really what the research is on whether or not these actually have an impact on, you know, device batteries like this, but I know that's something that people are starting to use to, you know, I guess, create cleaner power for their devices and help those device batteries last longer.
So there hasn't been anything that would indicate it's either way, whether it's better or perhaps worse.
Yeah, I mean, I just haven't seen a lot of research now that sways me one way or the other. But I guess time will tell as people use these if there's, you know, more luck with some than others.
Yeah, there you go, Jeremy. Thank you. Christine in Fitchburg, on to you now. Hi, Christine.
Hi. I'm wondering if it's authentic, the emails and texts I've received about Apple removing a lot of your pictures, most of your pictures in the month of July, or if that's a scam, because I've received several different notices about it, but I'm not sure they're really from Apple.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I would certainly, if you're getting emails that claim to be from Apple and you're not certain if they're from Apple, there's a way that you can take a look at that email that will tell you the actual address that that message is coming from. If you open the email message in whatever client you use to view it, there's usually a way you can drop down the top part of the message where the to and the from field are and the date. If you can expand that, it'll actually show you the email address instead of just the display name that that email came from. And if it didn't come from an @apple.com address, then it is certainly spam or some sort of phishing message.
Yeah, and it's always, you know, and if you're still wondering, I mean, it's always not a bad idea to go to apple.com and directly ask them if this message is, if these are legitimate messages.
Yeah, and if, you know, that specific message coming from Apple, I know that they did disable something called My Photo Stream back in July. So that may be what those messages were about, letting you know that if you had uploaded anything to something called My Photo Stream within iCloud, that they were going to start deleting those in July. And that you'd have 30 days from the date that they mention in order to download those to something else. So that may be what they were talking about. I would check those messages to see that they are actually coming from Apple, but it sounds like they're warning of a legitimate, you know, something happening with one of their services.
Hmm. Okay. Christine, good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Deneen in Elgin, Minnesota, emailed in. Should she keep her laptop on or should she shut it down each night?
Well, I'm probably the worst person to ask this because I leave mine on all the time and I know I shouldn't.
Yeah. Yeah, same,
you know,
here.
I very rarely shut it off. And I know that that's not good for it over time, that I should shut it down. And even just for security purposes, but not having it on and accessible when I'm not using it is a good idea. But as far as like the health of the machine, the longevity of it, wear and tear on parts within it, definitely wear and tear on the battery and the charging system. Shutting down the machine when you're not using it is a good idea, or at least letting it go to sleep so it goes into a low power state. I would recommend doing that when you're not going to be using it.
Amy from Milwaukee emailed, is fiber optic the fastest Wi-Fi internet connection that's available?
Yeah, you're definitely going to get the highest internet speed from what's called a fiber optic connection. That's a direct fiber connection is pretty much the fastest you provide internet service.
And see, here's another email. John emailed us. His Windows update wants to install Windows 11, and he's concerned that may cause more changes than he wants to cope with. Can he postpone this change without risk of outdated virus protection?
Well, it depends. If you're not using a third-party virus protection software or something like a Norton 360 or one of the other service providers, you may start missing Windows updates, which Windows updates really close known vulnerabilities within the operating system or the software that lives in the operating system. If you let your operating system get too far out of date, the vendor will stop providing updates for that software. So you don't want to let that go too long. I think if you're on Windows 10, let me just see how long they're providing updates for Windows 10. Let's see. It looks like there's still providing support and updates for that until October 14th of 2025. So that's really, you want to make sure you update to Windows 11 before then. Otherwise, you're no longer going to be provided security updates for that OS.
All right. So a little bit of time yet, anyway. Charity in Wanakee wonders how much data a car stores. Charity says they have a new car where you can plug your phone in and it plays music and has access to your map. And Beth, you mentioned that USB plugins store data. How worried should she be about her data getting stolen from her car?
Yeah, that's an interesting question because it's something where, you know, we've got to think about more and more that our devices kind of are everywhere now. And if we're connecting our personal device to something that may be out there being used by someone else, there's a possibility for some data to get transferred between the two. I wouldn't worry as much about your own car if it's your daily driver, if you want to sync your phone with it. You know, you may want to be careful about going through the security settings of the car system to see what data it collects and what it doesn't, what gets stored and what doesn't. It's really going to be particular to that car's system. Usually those come with a pretty thick instruction booklet that tell you more than you ever wanted to know. What I would be concerned with and what I've been concerned with myself is in a rental car or, you know, using something like Turo, like a car sharing service. If you're going to synchronize your personal device with the device that's built into that car, like synchronizing your contacts or your map data, that data could then be accessible to the next person who rides in that car. So I'd be really careful about allowing my personal device to synchronize with something that was going to be used by other people.
Yeah, that makes very good sense. David emailed, they have a Norton antivirus with VPN services. Each time they log into a secured site, like a bank or retirement funds, they're prompted for the dual authentication, even though they click remember this device. Is this because the VPN changes their computer's identity each time and they connect to the internet? If so, is there a way around it?
Yeah, it may be that if they're connecting through a VPN that the device is... So if you're connecting on your, say, you're on your laptop, you're connecting to your banking software through a VPN, you tell that banking software to remember your choice. There is no way for that software to actually know who you are to remember what your choice was last time because you're connecting through a VPN. It's obscuring your identity, your location. It's not allowing something like a cookie to be passed between that site and your local computer. So there's no way for that internet site to remember anything about you like your dual authentication. So it's going to ask you every time.
Yeah. David was also wondering about Norton. Their pop-up ads constantly try to sell David additional services. They all sound good and or necessary. Do they need any of the additional services to browse safely?
I think really just the main Norton 360 package is pretty comprehensive. In fact, I think even using the VPN all the time may be a little bit of overkill because it can get in your way a little bit, like the last question mentioned. I don't think any of the additional services are really necessary for just your standard use of the internet. If you're looking into doing more like financial business dealings or, you know, if it's a business account, then I would maybe look into some additional protections.
Beth D'Angelo, our guest today. Beth is a senior IT specialist with the UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology, and she's going to be with us right up until 12:30 today. You can join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us. We've got lots of good emails today at ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. We are going to take a quick look at the news. We'll find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we'll be back with Beth. Stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking technology on the show today, Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining in. Our guest is Beth D'Angelo, senior IT specialist of UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. She's worked in IT for more than 20 years. And as we talk with her, I hope you'll join in. Is your computer giving you problems? Maybe your phone or your watch? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. And let's take a call. Ted in Madison. Ted, thank you for calling.
Can you hear me all right?
Now I can. Go ahead, Ted.
Okay. So here's my issue. I don't know if you want me to issue brand names or not, but I'm using an MVN. Oh, that has a pretty liberal hotspot allowance to power my laptop, which is an older Windows format, you know, Windows 10. And what I find is that quite frequently, particularly middle of the day after 10, 15 minutes, it will kick me off my cell service. My cell service will get terminated. And then it takes me like 3-4 attempts of shutting the phone off and recycling again, which is an iPhone, to finally get my cell service reestablished. So I've contacted the tech support people, which, you know, they're basically just available by email or text. And we've gone through this like 3 times, and nothing they've come up with has ever worked. So I'm wondering, how might I escalate up to a higher level to get some attention to the issue? Or do I just have to change providers?
What do you think, Beth?
Yeah, that's, you know, it's possible that the internet service provider that you're getting your cellular data connection from is kicking you off at a specific time every day because they are ending your session and then recycling your address. So I know that there is generally, when you connect to the internet, you get you know, an IP address, so a destination out on the internet. And depending on who your provider is, there's a timeout limit for how long you have that address before it gets recycled and you get a new one. That may be what's happening. If you're seeing that happen, you know, regularly at the same time every day, it may be that that timeout period has been reached, and the way they have their system set up is to recycle your address. So you lose that connection for a little while until it picks back up. That would be something that your internet service provider would have to like look into log files to see if that's actually what's going on, and you need some kind of evidence of the dates and times that it was taking place so that you could kind of push back on them that it's a problem on their end of things. The other thing you could think about is getting a dedicated hotspot device. I'm not sure, I thought you said that you're using your phone for this. If you have a separate dedicated hotspot device, You may be able to get what's called a static IP address, or one that doesn't get recycled back into a pool regularly, so that you wouldn't drop that connection.
Hmm. Yeah, that's worth a look for sure. Ted, thanks for calling. Janet in Madison, your turn. Hi, Janet.
Hi. So I have an Apple Watch. It's the Series 3, and when I charge it, it barely lasts a day, and so it's really not very functional. So my question is there any hope for it, replacing a battery or something else I don't know about doing to help that matter? Oh, and if I get a new one, is your advice on charging the battery the same as for the phone, where you do sort of the stay between 50 and 100%?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the same advice for a phone, for a watch, for any kind of lithium ion battery powered device that you're using, to do that kind of soft charge and discharge, so that it's not going below 50% or really above that kind of 80 to 90%. As far as the Apple Watch and the battery life being pretty terrible on it at this point, you can have the batteries replaced on those watches. I know that they're not covered under warranty repair, but you can take it to an Apple store and have them replace the battery if you want to continue to use that same watch and not have to invest in a new one. I definitely wouldn't recommend going through the process to replace it yourself. You can buy kits that allow you to do that, but it's pretty tiny space to work in. There's a pretty high margin of error, and most of the third-party batteries that are sold for those are kind of substandard.
Oh. Janet, that sounds like good advice to me. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in, too, 800-642-1234. Give a call. June in Coon Valley emailed, they just discovered their son spent illegally watching movies on his laptop, which is connected to the family's Wi-Fi. He says he's doing it safely using a VPN and stuff, but June's wondering or worried that he might have let malware into the family Wi-Fi, and wonders what should she do next.
I mean, I would certainly be concerned about the machine that's connected to your Wi-Fi that has been streaming content through, like, an illegal service provider. That machine could certainly be infected with some sort of malware or virus. And if that machine is connected to the same kind of Wi-Fi system as other devices within your network, they could be, you know, vulnerable to, you know, being exposed to those same harmful malware or viruses. What I would do is, if you don't already have some sort of antivirus protection software on your systems that are connected to that Wi-Fi network, I would invest in one of those systems, put a virus protection software package on each of your devices, and run the scanning service within those to scan for any potential issues. I would also not allow that device to do that anymore on the Wi-Fi network, because you are opening yourself up to some potential harm.
Spencer sent us an email wondering what kind of external hard drive that you do you recommend, Beth? They have about 2,000 pictures they want off their desktop.
Yeah, there are some great external hard drives out there that are flash hard drives, so they don't have moving parts anymore. They're a solid state, so I would definitely invest in a solid state external hard drive. Nowadays, they've come down in price to the point where it doesn't make sense to really go for the ones with moving parts. Solid state hard drives are much longer lasting, less prone to corruption within the within the data that's stored on them, and they're very inexpensive now. You can get, you know, a 5 terabyte external hard drive for about $100 these days. That would fit more photos than you can possibly create.
Okay. Rick in Milwaukee, your turn. Hi, Rick.
Hi there. I have a Asus laptop that I'm using basically as a PC. I keep it plugged in usually to my monitor, and we have a Wi-Fi system. on the first floor, the Wi-Fi system is, and the Asus computer and the monitor upstairs, just about as far away through some rooms from the monitor, I mean, from the Wi-Fi as possible. There's no repeater, and I'm wondering if that's the problem, or I'm wondering if the recent Microsoft hacking problems are the problem. But what's going on is periodically it'll just disconnect, and I can't send or receive emails, sometimes for a couple of days. When it first started happening, I would just turn off the Asus computer for a while and turn it back on, and that seemed to solve the problem temporarily. Then that stopped working. A friend in IT told me to unplug and plug back in the, I forget what it's called. It's basically the Wi-Fi box. It's got some little ports that say 5G, 2.4G, et cetera. So I did that, and that seemed to work. But I'm just wondering if you have a long-term solution for this ongoing problem.
Yeah, it sounds like you may just have an issue with the distance between your Wi-Fi router, which is the box you were talking about with the 2.4 gigahertz and the text on it. If it's far enough away from the laptop that you're using, that connection could drop pretty frequently based on just, you know, losing signal. What I would recommend is a Wi-Fi range extender. They're pretty inexpensive, and it's a good way to kind of boost the signal out to a longer, you know, or a wider space. You're going to want a what's called a dual band. That's the 2.4 and 5 gigahertz so that it can work on either range depending on what your Wi-Fi router is set at. But you can pick those up for under $50. Linksys makes one. TP-Link is another company, or D-Link is another company. So there's multiple options out there for Wi-Fi extenders. They basically just plug into an outlet in your house. You put it like far enough away, or basically in between where your Wi-Fi router is and where your endpoint device is, so that it bridges that gap.
There you go, Rick. Thank you for calling. John wondered, called, couldn't stay with us. Are all charging bricks created equal? What can he look for in a good charging brick?
Definitely not all created equal. Certainly, like I mentioned earlier, is making sure that the charger that you're using is of the same manufacturer of the device that you're using. That'll ensure that the voltage is correct, that the component parts match up properly, and that there's not any, loss happening in that circuit that may happen with a third-party manufacturer's parts. So if you've got an Apple device, I would use an Apple charging brick. If you've got a Samsung device, I would use a Samsung charging brick. Same for the cord.
Patricia emailed periodically her phone, and she's got an Apple SE. It's 5 years old, not recognized by the CarPlay program in her car. Sometimes her computer will not recognize her phone either. All her attempts are through USB connections. After installing Apple updates, the problem seems to go away for a while, but invariably resurfaces. Is her phone just getting too old? It's 5 years old.
Yeah, likely what's happening is a difference in the type of USB signal that your phone is sending and the type of USB signal that whatever your phone is attaching to is receiving. So if there are different versions, sometimes it can start causing some data loss or some issues with recognition of the device. So say the device that you have is using USB 1 and the device you're connecting to uses USB 3. There are different protocols. They are compatible with each other, but there could be problems between them because of the older version of one versus the other.
Lewis emailed. He says he has he's positive his smartphone is listening to him even when it's shut off and on the table. The other day he was talking about the best duct tape, and then sure enough, there was an ad on his Facebook about tape. How can he shut that listening off?
Well, if it's powered down, it's not listening. But just having it in its sleep mode, you know, when you hit the side button just so that it shuts the screen off, that doesn't mean the phone is shut off. So if you really want to make sure that it's not listening to you, you have to power it all the way down. That way the microphone, speakers, all of that is actually powered off.
And see, Trixie from, we've talked about this a little, but probably bears repeating. Trixie wonders if you have some tips on creating a strong password without using a password manager app.
If you're not going to use a password manager app, it's going to get kind of difficult to remember if you're, you know, creating 15-character passwords with multiple special characters and uppercase, lowercase, things like that. What I do in that case is I tend to spell out a word or phrase, and I replace some of the letters with numbers or special characters. So if the word or phrase has an S in it, I would use the dollar sign or the number 5. If it has an E in it, I would use the number 3. Or if it has an I in it, I would use the exclamation point instead of the I, something like that. So I can remember what the phrase is, and then I can kind of know which special characters I would have put in there, and that'll help me keep track of the password and still be able to create a strong, really difficult to guess password.
Yeah, if you can string out a phrase, I mean, that is really hard to break, isn't it?
That's generally what I try to do, is to come up with some phrase that I won't forget, and then add those special characters in, and then, you know, with a combination of uppercase and lowercase letters as well, and potentially like substituting numbers for letters.
Jerry emailed. He's getting worried about AI. He likes the AI voices used for scam calls that sound like your relatives. And Jerry's wondering, just how do you feel about AI in general? Does it pose security risks?
Yeah, there's definitely risks involved with any kind of new technology that culturally we are unfamiliar with, you know, how it can be used for good and for bad. So really there's a steep learning curve whenever something new like, and AI isn't necessarily new, but some of the applications of it are. So really, like, I think if it's something that concerns you and something that you're interested in being able to spot when it happens, I would suggest reading some of the technical security information that's out there about it, keeping up with current news on how AI is being used within kind of everyday life, and just generally informing myself about kind of the different ways that AI is now kind of becoming more widespread. I think really it's just like any new tool that hits the market or that makes big news. There is, I think, a lot to be worried about until we really understand how it's being used, how it can be used, and kind of inform ourselves a lot about, you know, potential future state with it.
Yeah, I just saw an article, might have been in the Washington Post, about how professors are, you know, scrambling to figure out how to tell if somebody's used artificial, you know, somebody had something artificially written for them, a student.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's generally, there actually are tools that you can run text through to find out if it has been generated by something like a ChatGPT or any kind of AI text generator. But it's kind of easy to tell when something has been written solely in AI versus having a human perspective on it. And I'll relay a quick anecdote. We recently received a couple in my department, a couple of, not complaints, but feedback on an initiative that we made public. The complaints that came into us, we were able to tell pretty quickly that they were generated by AI. The person hadn't even taken the time to write this themselves, but had put a prompt into ChatGPT and use that as their kind of platform for complaining about a change. And it took a lot of willpower for us to decide not to respond to it using AI.
Oh, man. Melissa in Peshtigo emailed. She's wondering about Starlink, the idea that maybe Elon Musk was involved with. They say they were going to fly drones in rural areas. That would provide people with internet. And I haven't heard about the drone part.
Yeah, I think that may be one of Elon Musk's pipe dreams. I haven't heard about drones providing internet yet, but I know that there are several hundred satellites now orbiting in low Earth orbit that are providing broadband internet service to parts of the world that were never able to get such service. So some parts of Starlink are really cool.
Yeah. Billy in Rhinelander wonders, what does WPA2 mean in terms of Wi-Fi? Should he look for Wi-Fi with this?
Yeah, WPA2 is an encryption security protocol. So it's something that protects your data as it travels over your wireless internet connection. WPA2 is just really a way of encrypting your Wi-Fi password so that it's not seen in plain text, so that somebody can't steal your Wi-Fi signal.
And an email from Mary. They have an old account with sbcglobal.com, but they keep getting spam addresses to them at net and yahoo.com. They don't have any of those accounts. How is this letting through to their account? Currently, they have AT&T. They called them. They confirmed that they do not have an att.net account, and they said that Yahoo is letting it go through so that Mary will have to upgrade to more expensive plans. Any truth to this?
It's likely that, if your internet service provider is giving you a free service and then they want you to sign up for a paid service, that they're not providing the same protections on the free service that they are on the paid service. So it's possible that they're letting a lot more spam come through on the free side of a service than they would on a paid subscription side. So it's possible that that's what's happening.
Well, on that happy note, Beth, we are out of time. I want to thank you so much for spending time with us today. It was a lot of fun. I learned some things, and I think our listeners did as well. Thanks, Beth.
Thanks for having me, Larry. Have a great day.
You as well. Beth D'Angelo, Senior IT Specialist of UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. Great to have her with us. We'll have her back down the road, and we'll do this all over again. Taking a look ahead to tomorrow on the Larry Mueller Show, we uncover the letters of a Civil War soldier sent home to his family in Beloit. Great book about those letters. And we hear from a Wisconsin combat veteran who's recreating historic Civil War battles. That's tomorrow at 11 on the Ideas Network. In the meantime, thank you for listening. Please stay with us. Lots more in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.